This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, welcome back to TVI, episode 120. Carl Donahue here. Hi, hi. Hi Julian.
Hi man.
Welcome back, episode 120.
We're back
in the same country, same time zone. We've got a very funny, very good guest today, Garrett Millerick. Garrett, who I, again, this once he'd done that sort of over 100 episodes, you just don't remember who's been on it. I just assumed Garrett had already been on it, and he hadn't. So it's good we finally got him on. We have a fun chat about all sorts. That's it, really, isn't it? Any admin. We won't say it now. We've got an announcement about sort of episodes going forward. We're gonna start maybe moving some back to being in real life when we're in the same room.
IRL, mate, studio style.
Sort of. I think we'll keep a split though, because it's nice for guests who aren't London based to be able to get them on Zoom. Is nice, isn't it? Mm. But you know, other than that, I think we're gonna try and start doing some cool real life ones. Maybe even might be filmed and go out online. Who knows?
That'd be nice.
So we'll announce that once all the details are confirmed. But other than that, for now, you've got us chatting to Garrett Millerick. Thanks to all our patrons who've signed up. Patreon.com/WeArtVI. Go on there. Watch. If you sign up now, you go back and you can literally watch 18 months worth of bloody catch-ups that are ones that have never gone out in public. There we go.
There we are.
There we are. Enjoy the heat. Enjoy your weekend.
Enjoy life.
You went all robot-y as you said that. Enjoy your life.
Did I?
Yeah, it's quite. It was well timed. It was a well timed robot voice. Enjoy your life. Right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Enjoy us chatting to Garrett Millerick.
We're actually
changing the podcast. I think die of AIDS in an alleyway.
Hi everyone, welcome back to TVI, episode 120, with me, Carl Donnelly,
Julian Dean,
and guest Garrett Millerick.
Hello.
All the way from, where do you live? You live in Colchester?
Chelmsford.
Chelmsford, that's the sort of, I know the direction.
Yeah.
How's Chelmsford currently?
It's been, after years of not liking it very much, and feeling like bad that I left London, should never have left London, then we had this big old global pandemic, and you know, having a very small garden, two bedrooms and shops you didn't have to queue at,
yes,
absolutely lovely.
I mean, nice. We've talked about this a lot during the
how
pandemic.
Come you didn't have to queue, you just can fuck the queues off easy, you just got queues easier there.
There just were none. We got like a little
printed yourself a fake NHS badge.
Went full nurse's uniform and Summers.
Just rolling in. Sorry, guys. You know, I've got to get
dressed like Doctor Who.
I've got to get to my
key worker here. Key worker.
I've got to get to my ICU shift, guys. Get
pushing
out the
pregnant women out of my key worker here. Coming through.
I'm sorry. I need the last.
Need my cigarettes.
So it's just a quieter area, basically. Not London.
Yeah, it was a quieter. It didn't get very hectic around here during the pandemic.
It's an interesting one, like, because I live in, like, I had the experience of the both extremes in that, yeah. Where I live in Harlesden, at one point was the worst place in like the UK or something. Like we were on the news. They were interviewing people on Harlesden High Street about like how bad the cases were around here. It's because it's you know, it's quite a poor area. It's quite densely populated, and it's got a lot of people that were either key workers or were in low paid jobs that had to work throughout. Do you know what I mean? They weren't people that were getting furloughed and shit. So it was like a sort of a real hotbed of cases. But we live in a nice two-bedroom place with a garden, like, so we were very like felt a bit like hidden away from it all. But you literally come out my house, turn left, and you're suddenly in like sort of the fucking, you know, the guts of the COVID pandemic. It was a weird feeling. And like Tesco's was always as a massive queue.
Did you have a huge amount of middle class guilt about your garden? Were you sitting there going, oh,
absolutely not. I was like, this is fucking, this is what you fucking pay for,
no
mate.
Poor allowed sign up.
Yeah, definitely. No junk mail. No poor people.
No junk people.
Fucking hands off my doorbell, you freaks.
Just start sanitising the doorbell when they knock. Look at us in disgust.
I set up an electrified thing on it.
Shan't be clapping on a Thursday, not because I'm against the idea, I just don't want to mix with a bad
totally. Exactly. I didn't. Do you know what? I didn't do clap for the NHS just because...
you don't respect them.
I was like,
you clapped for COVID on a Friday.
That's the thing. He's just like, well, we live in a very poor area, but we do have a two-bedroom house with a garden and booper. So
basically, I didn't want people to be able.
So
to
no,
see
thank
my,
you.
I didn't want people to be able to see in the front door and see how nice it is.
Yeah,
shut my window at 6 p.m. on Thursday.
Yes, I've got quite a lot of bottled water, and that's for me.
But no, I'm fascinated. Like, I like this area genuinely. Like, I've sort of been here for a best part of a decade, like, and it's a funny thing, is we're on the very edge of Harlesden, right? And like, literally, if you turn left, you're in Harlesden, but if you turn right, you're in Kensal, and Kensal is like, this is the fascinating thing about London. You get like mad posh next to mad poor, do you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, yeah. I used to live in West Norwood, like right on the borderline with Dulwich, and it was that. If you turn right out the flat, you were at Dulwich College, and if you turned left out the flat, you were on Norwood High Street.
In
2 minutes either end. Yeah.
It's crazy. It's like, I suppose it's like Blackheath and Lewisham, innit? Do you know what I mean? Blackheath, you walk down that hill from Blackheath and it gets sort of like, you go from literally living in sort of the Victorian times. Thank where there's you. Like people like riding their horses on Blackheath.
There is horses that go past the window.
There's the stables on Blackheath. But then you walk down Lewisham and there's like just fucking nutters and shit just everywhere, isn't it? That's what I find here. Like, there is like, you know, proper one of the poorest areas of London there. And if you, I walked past a house with a for sale sign over the road, just literally the road directly opposite me, that is, you know, within, you can see Harlesden. And I just, out of curiosity, I was like, I wonder how much that's going for, because it's quite a nice look, like sort of free bed, you know. It's always, it's not a detached or anything, it's just like a sort of terraced house. It was going for £1.2 million.
Okay, now did you buy it?
I petrol bombed it.
We'd say either buy it or trash it.
That was the two options, mate. I went for option two.
Buy it or destroy it.
I was in a bad frame of mind. I just lost it.
If I can't buy it, no one can.
I'm sorry. I'd like to now publicly apologise to the owners.
I lived in Peckham for ages, and then I moved to East Dulwich. You know, real up in the world. And then I was there in East Dulwich for 3 days and got mugged.
It's fucking, because no one mugs anyone in like shit areas. I've never had a single bit of problem.
That's exactly what the police said to me, and I was like, oh, yeah. And he explained it to me, I was like, oh, that makes perfect sense.
It's a better
business model, isn't it, for the muggers?
If you're a mugger, you go where the fucking, you know, where the work is, as they would say. Like, you know, you got
The police said to me, I was like, oh, so you got mugged just up here. Yeah, that is actually the only bit of this street that isn't covered by CCTV. And it's like, right, so yeah, it's like they know.
Clever boys.
Clever muggers. Did they get anything off of you?
They got my girlfriend's purse, which had
anything of yours though, anything important?
No, I was fine. It was absolutely fine. Just
good job, lads. Good job.
Yeah. Although I had just taken her out for a very nice meal for a day after Valentine's Day, because we're both working Valentine's Day, so we'd had a really lovely evening. So in many ways, they took the evening away from us, which it was interesting. Yeah.
But you know, that's they have got to, you know, they've got to make their money. So
it's a job, you know.
I was really impressed with the police though, because they showed up in this like souped up car, like low suspension stuff, and all the police showed up, and they all looked about 12 and were wearing hoodies and stuff, and they were like, "Do you want to come in our car and drive around Peckham?"
Oh, really?
They were like, yeah, they're the undercover mugger squad.
Did you catch the muggers?
No, we didn't. And then
the cops mugged you again. enrolled for so long they forgot.
We were mugged by three white guys, and then I went to do the identity parade on a laptop, and they bring up all the pictures of the local ne'er-do-wells, and we were sat there, and the guy was like, "Okay, if you want to go through." So I went through about three, and I said, it's bit of a problem. The guy was like, "What?" And I was like, "These are exclusively pictures of black people, and I did say that we were mugged by three white guys." And the guy like nearly fell over out the door, and there was this huge commotion outside the game. And it's like, "Oh, terribly sorry, we just loaded up the police."
I pressed the wrong button.
"It's all right, mate. I won't tell anyone about this until I'm on podcast in 10 years' time."
What's that they say about institutional racism in a police force?
Then they did, when they brought up the pictures of the guys who were the local people who are sort of known to be muggers and stuff, all these pictures of these guys just like snarling, like real kind of fuck you facial expressions. And he thought, like, if you just put on a neutral facial expression when they took your photograph, you get so
just
less
like
likely
me?
To be picked out.
Not guilty.
Just walk around with a big old grin on your face all the time.
Just look up at a corner, get a good headshot.
Be lucky. Do the comedian one with the hand coming out the back of the head.
Oh, God, just rubbing your head.
Holding a mic stand with a loosened bow tie.
Just a paisley shirt.
One of those 1930s microphones that you see a lot in comedy clubs these days.
Yeah, of course. But they whenever I see one of them on a fucking
some
poster,
crooner,
I'm like, that photographer needs to be headbutted, mate.
A lot of the comedy photographer tropes is like, come on, you've got four things. You can't. It's a very small pool of people. You can't.
Yeah.
There was one time my PR put me onto this photographer site. It's really good. And then me, Alfie Brown, and like three or four other people all ended up with the same shots to be paid for. And we're like, same background and everything. And like, well, we're all going to have these redone.
Yeah. It's
another 600 quid.
There tends to be, I find it goes through phases of like, right, oh, now we're all against a yellow backdrop, looking sort of slightly wistful. We go through a four-year period where every poster's that, and you know, and before that, it's sort of everything's a novelty poster or something. That suddenly we're all, you know, it feels.
We've had a decade. I would agree with you. It's sort of, it goes in sort of 2 to 4 year things, but the decade of the. We are not smiling. We look like lots of people scowling. They look like you're about to be told off.
Yeah.
Like I said that about my show last year, or whenever the last one we were allowed to do was, that I ended up on the poster. It only occurred to me like 2 days into the run. I ended up looking like somebody who was trying to be like elected the leader of a revolution that nobody asked for. Stern expression on the face.
Yeah, it's you know, I don't think there should be any rules to posters, don't get me wrong. I think it's an absolute free-for-all, but you know, there is sometimes you can see a poster sometimes and know who's producing the show. So like, oh right, that's one of their, they've organized the photo shoot, they've sort of slightly overly directed the production and the graphic design, and just all their posters look like the same sort of thing. And it's almost like you think, hang on, they're doing that for their own branding essentially, whereas the comedian should have absolute control over what their poster is.
Are you getting into a conspiracy about big agencies now using other people's money to secure their branding? Because that's, I mean, Edinburgh's happening again this year. Let's get into it, guys.
It is. Let's wait and see what the poster selection is before we talk, you know.
Are you doing Edinburgh, Garrett?
Yeah, I am. I'm doing 5 days, I think.
Okay.
Oh, okay. That's
cool.
A nice little.
Yeah, it seemed like a good idea. They caught up and they were like, okay, in this one time slot, you're doing like 5 days, and then Pierre Novelli's doing the same time slot for like 5 days afterwards, and then someone else is taking. I was like, great, just pop up,
That's how Edinburgh hopefully will continue to go. But then there is a few people I've seen doing a full run. I'm like, are you fucking mad?
Yeah, fuck off.
Literally to go from 2 years of like nothing essentially to suddenly go, I'm going to do a full run. I just did, you know, I was very lucky to do the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I was in Melbourne for 5 months. Pure sort of, you know.
How did you get out?
Well, basically, towards the end of the year, we had a, you know, we had a baby who was starting to become very mobile. We were in winter lockdown here. We were like, we want to get to Australia so she can spend time with her grandparents at this quite crucial stage of her development. And so we applied for an exemption for me to be allowed into Australia. My wife is Australian. My daughter is registered as an Australian born overseas. So she's got dual passports from birth. So basically we managed to get me an exemption and got in and did quarantine and all that business. And it sort of all coincided with Melbourne announcing they were doing the festival. And then I was like, guys, I'm going to be in the country. And they were like, fucking, let's have you then. Because we've got no internationals, essentially. So I ended up just going from a winter lockdown with no gigs. I was doing a couple of Zoom gigs a week. And I suddenly went into doing an intense, like, 2 month period of like full on gigs. So I did the comedy festival, then I went and did Roadshow and did Sydney Comedy Festival. I went on this like, and it was the most exhausting thing I've ever done because I was out of practice. Do you know what I mean? It was, normally with Edinburgh, you go into it off quite an intense period of previews. So you sort of are a bit gig fit. But fuck man, I was knackered at Melbourne just because I was like, I'm not fit for this at the minute.
So are you coming to Edinburgh to do a full run this summer to show everyone how it's done? You've been in the gym, you're going to show off your comedy abs.
I'm not even going up to the city for the month. I'm going to let everyone else do it.
Nice.
Sit back and watch how it goes because I'm so paranoid that the Scottish government have a bit of a hair trigger. Anything could happen where it just goes at the last minute.
I'm still sort of 10% on whether or not it'll happen, but I thought, sod it, I'll put it.
They're doing a lot online, aren't they, Edinburgh, this year, or not?
I think the plan was to do that.
Yeah.
I've not read one email, I've just been in the market.
I just saw online, I think. You're not interested, you're not coming up?
No. No,
I mean Julian's not interested in going out in normal years.
I've never liked it really. To be honest, I wouldn't mind a little 5 days. Sounds nice,
mate. You still hate that? You hate doing normal gigs.
I like it if they're local.
You like them if they're local, and there's literally no pressure whatsoever on the gig.
I was in Manchester Friday. I drove there, but I got a hotel like halfway. But that was lovely, but it's still so far.
Yeah,
it's a trek.
But I do, I don't think there's any way that Edinburgh could work that you would enjoy it. I genuinely say that as somebody
I genuinely don't enjoy the buzz or anything of it.
No. Well, the worst thing about this year was just to get asked to do 5 days. I'm like, okay, yeah, that's great. Yeah. It's my wife's birthday just after the run finishes. So I was like,
can you swerve that then? Yeah.
No, she's going to come. So I was like, me and the baby can go camping. No, I was like, okay, we can, because normally her birthday is ruined by Edinburgh. So I was managed to turn this one into something of a sort of opportunity. Was like,
that's
okay,
good.
We can go on a little
get
holiday
a free afterwards. Ticket to your show as a present or something.
I think so. Yeah, I'll be like, I'll get you a venue pass.
If it's the day before, then she pays, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, if we've sold out.
No.
I mean, that's money. That's
sorry,
money
there's a few press holds left, but we are hoping that we get some reviews.
Yeah. And she, like, at the end, she hasn't got a job at the moment, so I'm the one breadwinner. So I'm, you know, we can't entertain that. So if you and the baby want food, you're going to have a.
Yeah.
Let's talk
your
about
own show,
baby, because I've not spoken to you since that happened.
Because we gigged together just before,
you told me when it was going to happen, which was great news.
Yeah.
So when did the baby show up?
February.
February, lovely stuff. How are you finding it?
I'm really enjoying it. I have to admit, I'm not doing the heavy lifting, obviously, because of the feeding and things. So I'm really having a good time. Which you told me that was the first thing when I told you my wife was pregnant. You just said you're going to have such a good time, and you're correct.
It's quality. I genuinely still feel like either I'm mental or I've been lied to for my whole life, because like we're now at, you know, she's coming up to 14 months old, and I just love it. I love spending time with her constantly. Like there's no part of me, like I'm doing Birmingham this weekend gigs, right?
Yeah.
I've worked out the trains where I can get as late a train as possible today. because I'm closing the gig, so I can get a late train at dinner time, do the gig, I can get the last train back from Birmingham to be back at like 1 a.m, whatever, wake up home tomorrow, spend a day, and then go as late as possible to Birmingham tomorrow. And I can't get back, so I'm getting the earliest train on Sunday. Like, that is how desperate I am to not spend time away from her. And she's 14 months old.
I did find when everything opened back up, I kind of threw myself into club gigs. And I did 2 weekends on the trot. And I found it really miserable. I've never bothered being on the road before. I was sitting in a shit hotel room in Cardiff, just on my phone, looking at pictures of my daughter, being like, I don't really want to.
Mate, honestly, I don't really. I know, you know. I'm used to hearing stories of guys like when they're like going, "Oh, mate, I'm so glad to be away. I just get a good night's sleep." And I'm just like, I don't care about any of that shit. I can live without sleep. Do you know what I mean? It's fine. Yeah. I hadn't spent a night anywhere away from her for her first year of her life, just under a year. So I'd never ever been away. Obviously that was COVID dependent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But then in Australia, then I had to do this thing called the road show, which is like a tour after the Melbourne Comedy Festival. And I had to spend 5 nights away, and it was, I was miserable. Like, normally the road show is a party and you're like, ooh, I just sort of just moped around, sort of feeling like I didn't want to be there. And I loved the gigs. The gigs were great when I was on stage, but yeah, the rest of it, I was just a bit sad.
Well, maybe
I'm
this
a bit
is,
like
this
that
is,
in Edinburgh.
This, yeah, this explains Julian's antipathy, because you've been a father for quite some time, haven't you?
Mm. So, I think that's it. The first time I went, 2010, I missed my kids so much.
Yeah.
I felt choked for the first... When I got to the room... Because you got this... It was my first full run in Edinburgh. I was doing the Big Value, and I got to the... We booked the accommodation I got to. It was right on Nicholson Street. I don't know what picture I had in my head, but I got there, and it was just like this dead room. And like, there was, it was the first, you know, when you're the first one at the flat.
One thin pillow.
Yeah, and it was like this single bed.
Oh man, them wafer thin Edinburgh pillows, man.
I felt choked in my throat, like.
Yeah.
And I knew I had the whole month there, and as it went on, and no one could relate, no one else had kids.
Yeah.
Everyone was partying and loving the vibe, and it was just sensory overload. And I was just sitting in like, the caves. It's like a nightclub in the night, and just sitting there like missing my kids. And like the only one guy
damp
went,
walls and stuff.
Yeah, and like things would drip. It was like fucking so dank in there. Really. I mean, it's great. It's a great venue, but like things were dripping off onto my arm when I'm like on stage.
Yeah.
But the gigs I loved, but it was just the rest of it and a whole month of
23 hours of the day.
I think that's a big part of it, like having kids. Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally changed my whole view of being away for any sort of longer than a few hours from my house. That is all it's done.
Look at us cool modern dads being like,
I know.
Bloody love our kids.
Yeah. I don't know, but I genuinely don't know if it's a generational thing or if it's a personal thing. I still know I've got mates who have kids who definitely love being away from them. Like, you know, I've got a routine about stag do's when you go on it and there's always a guy who fucking hates his life. And like,
my brother-in-law stag do was like that. Just loads of people who were like, I'm away from my wife and kids for one night. And they were just like, Coke bottles fizzing over. You're like, this is a bit bleak.
Exactly. Yeah. But I also...
Oh, great success.
But I reckon we are in a sort of slightly privileged position of being comedians. We get to spend a lot more time with our kids. I've spoken to a couple of mates of mine who've got proper jobs and all that, and they basically said they didn't really feel like they got to know their kids in the first couple of years of life, because babies are sort of, you know, you've either got to spend a lot of time with them to have to create a bond, you know, or you're just not really going to get that bond until they're a toddler and they've got a personality and they want to get, you know, they can actually have some communication with them. But I was just there from day one, and she, you know, so much because of COVID that I feel like that bond just fucking clicked very, very early on. Mm. And I just sort of obsess about her. I'm obsessed with her. It's what, like, sort of pathological. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just sit with her for hours.
What a nice pathological obsession, though.
It is. It's the best one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great. Are you doing like all the hippie stuff? So she breastfed. What is the child? A little girl.
That's a girl.
That's the best one as well.
How old is she?
Yeah, well, I did. She is now 5.5 months.
Aww.
I was saying on stage the other night that, you know, obviously hugely relieved not to have a boy. because you don't want to bring another white man into the world. Ugh. And then
I real racist boy.
And then absolutely. God, awful, problematic.
That's a funny bit. That's a funny idea for a routine.
Yeah.
But there is definitely part of me that was like, you know, in terms of the shifting power dynamic of the world, you're like, we are, you know, quite rightly, we used to be the fucking alpha, you know, the apex predator of the world, the white
rise
man.
Up kings.
But quite rightly, in the last, you know,
chin up, brothers, the last time will
years.
Come again.
But this is very much
man down.
There's been a shift. There's a shift, and things are, you know, gradually getting more equal across the board, right?
Yeah.
There's still work to do, but like, you know, I don't think you can get away with what you used to as one of us, right? So part of me is like, you know, I'm quite glad I've just got a little girl because she, you know, she's coming in as they're on the rise, isn't it? You know what I mean? Get one whose is rising.
This is what I thought. And then I realized that actually she was going to be a quite affluent white lady whose parents work in the arts, and they're the worst people on the planet.
That is true.
It's sort of dodging a bullet and getting hit by a missile.
She's a Karen in waiting, isn't it?
No offense to any Karens.
She's going
to
have a Guardian column by the time she leaves Cambridge.
Oh, God, yeah. Fuck you. It is a fun, I mean, it is, you know, that's part of the thing I've tried to stop myself doing is hypothesizing about what she's going to be and what she's going to be like. And you just,
my dad told me about that. Like, it's basically, there's nothing you can do about it. He was like, you work out very quickly that you're just a caretaker.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the best quote I read about parenthood, which was in pre parenthood,
get them adopted, Dalai Lama.
Parenthood is essentially signing up to be taken for granted for a huge part of their life. Yeah. You know what I mean? So they're going to take you for granted until they're probably in their 30s, and then they're going to go, oh, actually,
get a father's day card. Hey?
Yeah. But, you know, most of
post
the time,
it to him.
You ain't shit. You're just that fucking guy who puts the rules in place. And, you know, everything, all the other stuff you did goes unseen, doesn't it? So
Simon Munnery had that great thing about he was coming home from the hospital with his daughter, and the taxi driver was like, yeah, I got girls. You know, they steal. And then he mentioned it to a friend of his, like, do you steal? And she's like, no. And he's like, from your dad? And she went, that's not stealing.
Yeah. It is, like, but it's fun. It's fun. It's that wicked, that early stuff is when it's all the milestones. So when they start walking, that's funny as fuck, man. They just become like, and when they start really communicating, even though they can't talk, we're in that bit now. She can walk totally, like she's off around the house all the time, but she can't speak yet, but she clearly wants to speak, but she hasn't got the physical development of her vocal cord. So she's like a gremlin just walking around, like making these funny noises that sound like she's trying to talk. So it's just like having a little drunk just nutter running around the house.
I still haven't got
funny.
Over the smiling yet. Like, that's the one still, just like we see her in the morning and she goes,
yeah.
Great. Julian, so you're way further down the road than we are on this. Mm-hmm. Like, what, and you've got how many kids? Two, three?
Let me just, five altogether. Yeah.
By the time the fifth one was smiling, we were like, I just don't care anymore.
You know what, the fifth one, actually, I probably, I mean, all of them I have good relationships with, but the fifth one I do more with, I guess, one-on-one.
Right.
So, like, Ren, that is. So I take her swimming. I never really had the one-on-one time as much with the others because they were 40 months together and they were, like, their mum was more involved. I don't know why, it's just ended up like that, but...
Yeah.
So, yeah... I don't know. Plus, I feel like I've had a lot of practice.
I'll
tell you what, I'm a so much more easygoing with Ren as well.
Well, I think, you had kids young as well, which I think is a big, you know, and obviously she came on when you were older. I look at young parents and I'm like, how are you doing this? Because, like,
you've got more, you've got almost more stamina and stuff. You just don't need as much sleep or maybe.
And also, you just don't want to, all the other things that you you might think you're missing out on in your third, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, now my favourite time.
Shit.
is taking her swimming or something like that. That's my I wouldn't choose anything else. Partying or, you know, whatever with my mates. That's my favourite thing to do. So it's that's probably why.
Interesting thing yesterday.
I'm an old geezer.
Yeah, that's it's not, isn't it?
But we all are. This is very much a.
I read a thing, and I didn't know anything that had happened that had led up to this. But basically, it was some Twitter thing in the last week. A journalist died called Dawn Foster, who I'd never heard of. You know, by all accounts, she was a good journalist and she was very nice. So a lot of people were very sad about that, right?
Apart from Giles Corran, who
This is it. So Giles Corran, apparently, she had criticised him a bunch of times on Twitter openly. And he did a tweet sort of saying, like, what's the rules when somebody who trolled you dies? Are you allowed to sort of laugh and go, ha, ha, ha? But be sad. But he said, like, but be sad for their families, whatever. And everyone's now fucking upset and saying, oh, God. And, like, but we, I mean, I've got no idea about that, what happened between those two people. So I couldn't give a shit. That's the truth. Sad to say, I didn't know who she was. I barely know who he is. Yeah. I hear his name every now and again because he does something that, like, is a bit cunty.
Yeah.
But a lot of people were. I saw a bit of people sharing this thing that he wrote saying Giles Corran hasn't got any place to criticise anyone after writing this sort of pedo shit. And basically, he'd written an article about his daughter when she was 3 years old and about how he went on. I think he must have gone on a little like weekend away, just him and her. And he wrote about it in this sort of. He basically said it was the most romantic weekend of his life. You know, he said in the sense of you literally sit around with them, staring at them, like you're in love so much. And it was everything he wrote. He sort of, but then he said there is one bit where he sort of said it's sexual and like in the sense of I think he's trying to allude to the fact that previously you'd have thought about all this stuff you're doing as a sexual endeavor, but actually when you have a daughter and you're a dad. You look at them, all the things that used to be to have that don't have that anymore, and you're just staring into their eyes. And
I wouldn't have wrote the sexual bits down.
The word sexual,
or the romantic bit.
The sexual bit. I think is the one
she
where
she needs an editor.
Yeah, basically,
as a professional journalist, you've got to know you're going to settle some alarm.
But weirdly, like apart from that word, everything he wrote, I was like, that is absolutely spot on. As much as he's a fucking knob, right? By all accounts.
So you're set for the boner.
But you're saying something he wrote years ago was willfully misinterpreted to throw it on a charge sheet of a Twitter
I suppose,
rant.
Yeah, that's what's happened here. But actually, people were going, this is what he's written is pedos. And I read it, I was like, I can understand you thinking that word's a bit out of place in that bit, but everything he's written, other than that, I thought it was really lovely. I was like, that's a really lovely thing to write about your daughter.
I suppose he's talking, I don't know, I didn't read it, but he's on a very deep level. Like, if you read some of Freud's stuff, it's like fucked up, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
To be honest, Julian, I think you should have at it comment, because I wouldn't have thought many people who were commenting on Twitter read it either. So just
I'll block him then. I'll block him.
But yeah, but it was a weird thing because I literally didn't know any of the background to what was happening in this Twitter storm, which isn't a storm. It's probably 300 people tweeted out of fucking 8 billion people. Yeah. But like, that was the one thing I read, and like all the criticism, I was like, I think actually that's quite a sweet thing he's written there. And you know, if anything, I've always just heard about him being a bit of a knob, and that reading that made me go, I think he's probably actually quite a nice guy.
But did you do a tweet going, hey guys, I actually think this is really sweet? Did you do that tweet?
Well, no, because I wouldn't do a tweet ever. I mean, my tweets are a dumb joke, or I'm retweeting a link to a gig I'm doing. I've got that's my 100. That's
what,
my policy.
From your other accounts, just pure hatred.
Yeah, that's hatred, mate. That is just attacking Marcus Rashford every day.
I would say that is not an effective.
Your
way
other
to
alias,
use your platform.
Andrew Lawrence.
He's back now. He's back. He had a little break, and he's back.
Is he
Andrew
back?
Lawrence back on Twitter?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, is he? Oh, cool. Yeah, oh, cool. That's good to know. He's back.
He didn't delete the tweets either.
So hang on. Did he suspend his own account?
That's the thing you do. If a bar fight breaks out around you, you can just go and stand outside till it's petered down.
You can suspend your own account. I'd do that fucking every other week for a week just to sort of Anyway, but it's, yeah, I didn't, I very rare, I don't mean, I never venture into any of these Twitter arguments. I actually normally miss them. I just see them now and again.
Yeah.
When I've gone on to search, is Harry Kane leaving Tottenham? That's basically my, I go on Twitter for football updates.
Yeah.
And, I only see things because I get sent them, really, and then I go and search them.
There is that as well. There's getting sent a screenshot in a comedian's WhatsApp group.
If it's someone the thing you is, know, when you... it's fun.
Yeah. When you tell people that you don't want to, you're like, oh yeah, I sort of don't really look at it. And then you're on WhatsApp and people screen grab your stuff and send it to you and you go, no, the reason that I'm not on it is I don't want to see this stuff.
I don't mind that though. I don't mind the one step removed. If somebody does the legwork for me and sends me something going, look at this fucking prick, I'm like, oh, I can live with that. We can have a conversation about it.
I like it if someone's really riled up about it and I'm not really. And I'm like, it's funny watching how people are annoyed people.
I love it. I love watching people at the minute. This is anytime I open it just to look at I've muted so many people, I've muted so many words, you know, I genuinely have tried to curate it into funny pictures and funny jokes, funny videos and football information, right? But still there's certain comedians that get through the cracks, and like at the minute I just keep opening it and there's comedians having discussions about the vaccine. I'm not fucking hell, guys. Like, out of everyone in the world, I want the opinion of on the vaccine. Two comedians who I know have absolutely no brains other than being able to write a funny joke are not the people I sort of want that information from.
That is the problem with comedians, like, latterly. It's all things like vaccines, climate change, politics and stuff, like, well, blah blah blah, and coming in with this. It's since they started allowing comedians on Question Time and everyone's like, right,
oh
okay,
my god,
like, we are phenomenally ill-informed people.
And also we
don't have the stresses and the strains of normal working members of society either.
No, we don't even commute with everyone. We don't
we're totally outside of it. We've got an ego. Anyone, like, we've got the same level, I think the same level of ego as politicians. You know, there's a whole thing about anyone who wants to be in that position you shouldn't trust their opinion. Mm. I think comedians are that as well. Like, anyone who thinks they should be, you know, in a room full of strangers sitting one direction, you should be the one turning the other way.
With
a
microphone in your hand.
Your opinion should be discounted.
The loudest voice in the room.
The moment you turn around is what
a comedian said a phenomenal thing to me the other day, and he really hit the nail on the head. He said, comedy has really suffered in the last 10 years from the decline in journalism internships.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think it's declined because people are getting a bit too fond of their own voices rather than the sound of an audience laughing, which used to be the main driver behind being a comedian.
But that thing with things, sort of like, am I mad? But it's like, is this? Yeah, probably. It's like the thing, like an Edinburgh show is about the same word count as an undergraduate politics dissertation.
Yeah.
But does not require the same level of notations and reading to the right one. So people come out and just like, but that's what we do. Like, it's a kind of magic trick in terms of getting people to listen to you. But that can be. I think it's fine as long as you're like, it's a piss take and the whole thing's a piss take. It's when you go, oh yeah, but actually I will lead the charge in this. They go, no, there are.
I read a funny article about Bo Burnham's special on Netflix, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. I loved it. I thought it was funny. I thought it was incredibly produced. You know, the work put in was next level. I just thought it was really great. And yeah, I did like, even though it goes the old sort of quite extreme, dark last sort of third. I just thought as a piece of work, it was quality. And I laughed. It had a few moments that made me laugh as much as anything I've ever watched, right?
Yeah.
And I just read this article. Even me. the first time I heard your bits. But it's just diminishing returns for a decade.
Got some new bits now, guys. Can you see me tonight? Vauxhall comedy.
Are you at Vauxhall tonight? Quality.
Reading.
Sorry,
you were saying.
But this article was somebody that they were criticising the special for being irresponsible in its sort of. They sort of said Bo Burnham is suggesting that he lives in this bedsit. And he's stuck there, and it's like, and it's sort of a, because it covers his mental health. It was like, it suggests he's just this lonely man in his bed, sit stuck there. And I was like, no, at no point of watching it did I think, well, this is Bo Burnham's, like, this is Bo Burnham's whole house that he's living in. I was like, this is probably his workspace.
Even if it is, it's a comedy show.
Well, it's a comedy show, but also, the whole point is he's got to do a special, and he's locked in his house. And I was like, oh, this is his little studio. He's to make his special, and the show is about his diminishing mental health during lockdown, but also with the pressure of trying to create a Netflix special on your own in your fucking studio. Like, that's the point of the show. Throughout it makes loads of comments on the world and social media and the pressures that are on people now, even in your own house. And I don't understand how a journalist couldn't make that leap to get to that and actually would assume that, oh, well, loads of people are watching this and thinking Bo Burnham is a poor sort of man who lives in a bedsit. It's like, no one thinks that. He's a multi-millionaire actor, director, comedian.
Also, who cares? Like, as long as they're enjoying it, as long as it's funny, that's the whole deal. That's all you're paying for. Like, it doesn't have to be anything more than that. So as long as it satisfies that, he's done everything that he...
He hasn't got to be responsible for anything, is he? I know. Either watch it or don't,
I mean, I know I saw some people saying, like, I know a couple of comedians that didn't like it and they did bloody tweets going, like, it's not comedy. And it was like, so what? If you didn't like it and think it was funny, that doesn't mean it's not comedy. You know, comedy's art. Comedy is like art. It's not art.
Red Richardson said to me a couple of years ago, we were talking about something similar to this, and he went, what happened to people just going, oh, that's not my cup of tea?
It's not comedy, actually.
Yeah. You like go, there's loads of stuff. Like, I don't like football, but it doesn't make me angry that other people do. Yeah. See that, you know, there's things for... There's so much stuff now, particularly with the internet. It's like you can go and seek out your own thing. But on the flip side of that, it does annoy me when people who like certain genres of something are like, right now we're here, all other genres need to go away. And you're like, like we all like Led Zeppelin, and you're into Christian rock. That's cool. Now all rock music doesn't get deleted because you're like, everything has to be about the Lord. And there's been a real kind of movement towards that. And you go, it's not helpful or mature.
It's true. It's also the assumption that you're sort of, especially if it's in types of comedy that work in certain types of room, that sometimes I've had quite casual green room conversations with comedians after they've had, you know, a bad gig at a big weekend club.
And it's a nice chat, man. It meant a lot.
You know, we had to talk Julian down off the window ledge.
He's hanging out the window of the Glee. I took the roof off, by the way.
But like, where their suggestion was that, you know, they were like, yeah, this sort of gig isn't really for me. You know, it doesn't. My stuff doesn't really work here. And part of me is like...
They say that at every gig.
Yeah, but they've said it in a tone as if the gig is the issue there. It's like,
I know, yeah. Smart for them.
If you took the gig, you must have had a suspicion that you'd be able to do well at the gig. And it's almost they retrospectively are saying, well, you know, actually, it's probably them. They're not really my sort.
Some people think their stuff is smart just because they mention Plato, but it just goes to a cock joke. And like, just because you say the word Shakespeare,
they think
doesn't
it's smart
make
because
it clever.
It's not, but you know, it doesn't follow the standard form of a joke in that it doesn't end on a big laugh. But like, you know, it's that thing of I've seen Simon Munnery kill the Glee. Do you know what I mean? Simon Munnery, well, you would not say is a mainstream comedian. Like, he's about as alternative as, you know, Phil Kaye, people like that, mad fuckers stuff on stage that, you know, it's beyond anything. Like,
Kitson did it everywhere, didn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, Kitson, I think, crosses that line between
Kitson, you know, Dean. You know what I mean?
The two big guns, Blur and Oasis.
The two big bollocks of comedy, Billy Ballbags, Billy Big Nuts.
But yeah, I just think, you know, I totally get it. I think you do have to curate your own gigs. I stopped doing Jonglers way before they shut because I actually did find them hard to play. I found it hard to do it on their terms as audiences. Yeah. And that is one. And I didn't want to give him a bad night. I was like, let another comedian who can play these gigs do it and kill it.
Sometimes they were just too rowdy, though. Like, it they couldn't even, it was just too much.
Totally. Yeah. But I'd made the decision that I wasn't the right act for the gig. And I stopped doing the gigs rather than do the gig and afterwards go, yeah, I just didn't really get what I do. You know what I mean? It's like, fucking have some self respect, you know?
I did an open spot in Wimbledon years ago with this guy, and he went out, and his set was predominantly about sexually abusing kids.
Okay.
Absolute.
You know, should have said hi, man.
And like really sort of like dark stuff, and then like murdering women and stuff. And we were having a cigarette immediately afterwards. And he died. Just complete silence because there wasn't. It wasn't funny. Are we having a cigarette?
It's weird,
it just wasn't funny. And we're having a cigarette outside, and he was just like, yeah, I'm quite ahead of my time. And he went, a lot of audiences aren't ready for really dark shit.
Oh,
and
it's God.
Just like, they've all been at work all week, and you just went out and said a series of horrible things.
It's just like their ego protecting
nothing.
Themselves, isn't
I'm
it?
I'm ahead of my time. Yeah, it's weird, actually, that audiences aren't on board with pedo yet, being a pedo.
But it's like, you can say whatever you like, but there wasn't a joke there. You just said a series of horrendous things. Like.
Absolutely.
And you're like, yeah, you can't take hearing that. It's like, well, no, I mean, everybody can take hearing anything. It's just there has to be a point to it.
And also you have to be charming enough and funny enough to do it. Look, someone like Jim Jefferies is a fucking worldwide star.
Yeah.
And Jim's done some stuff that is absolutely horrific on paper.
But always with good joke structure in there.
Well, he knows what he's doing. He's a charming guy. He's always, one thing I will say, you know, and Jim will get his detractors, but I've worked with Jim loads. I supported him on his last UK tour when, like, before he got America famous.
Yeah.
And, you know, watching Jim night after night, it's not what I would do on stage. It's not my sort of stuff that I would do as a comedian. But there was always a sense of vulnerability to him that he was aware that I'm a fucking dickhead. You know what I mean? There was a self-awareness.
Skillful people do that. They become the butt of it in a sense.
Yeah, he was always...
Like Bill Burr does that, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's when people like talk about punching up and punching down and stuff. You know, if you watch the really good people, it's always punching inwards.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw a really funny...
I'm an idiot like that.
Jamie someone. I need to remember his name. He's Glaswegian act.
Fox.
And he had a really funny joke when I geeked with him at the Glasgow Glee, I think, or Glasgow Stand. And he basically said, you know, there's a lot of talk in comedy about punching up. You know, you can't punch down, you can only punch up. And he was like, I'm from Glasgow, I'll punch any fucking person I want. it's a really funny joke.
Well, Chris Rock said that about punching down and up, didn't he? And people have just kind of been saying it ever since.
I know, it's sort of like, it's, I think it's a bit of a non-argument. Like, I just think anything can be funny if it's done in the right way, and it doesn't matter who you're punching.
Yeah, and if it's a bit mean to a disabled kid, it's just, I don't think people will laugh anyway.
I don't either.
Yeah. Unless the disabled kid looks hilarious. Not really. But like, I don't think people will laugh, will they?
No. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? The test is when people go, if something's unacceptable, like, you know when something's unacceptable because there will be silence after you've said it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, audiences are really good at being self-policing entities a lot of the time.
I don't think the worst audience would laugh if you just went up and did a joke about a Down syndrome kid.
No.
Laughing at them.
Yeah.
No.
You know, like, who would laugh at that?
I think actually a lot of this chat about punching down sometimes actually shows a lack of trust in the audience.
Yeah, definitely.
The sort of judges of what's being said.
Yeah, it's when I started, it was like Louis C.K. and Bill Burr and stuff were kind of big guys, Jim Jefferies and things. And somebody explained to me, I cannot remember who it was, but like people trying to go dark and do like really edgy stuff. They said it's basically when they're watching guys like that do it, it looks really effortless, but essentially it's that watching that sushi chef who can prepare the fish where if you get it wrong a millimeter on either side, you kill the diner.
Yeah,
and it's like
definitely.
An open micer going up to the fish with a mallet going, I've got this.
Just with his eyes closed, just smashing up the table.
definitely. It's like, what are you going to try and do for your first set? It's like, well, I'm going to try and tackle some racism. I'm going to go in pretty hard on that disability. That's sort of like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Because it's always the same as well. And this isn't criticizing. You know, it's not criticizing all new acts, but you know, we all make the same mistakes. When I was a new act, I had jokes about paedophilia that I thought were fucking great, and ultimately they're just essentially puns based on a horrific topic, and you just get it out of your system as quick as possible. Hopefully, you know, for me it was very quick that I was doing that, and then was like, what am I talking about? And I learned not to. But yeah, some just don't seem to learn.
I've got an excellent pedo joke, but
I mean, you have, but yeah, it, again, you're a good enough joke writer that you
this is correct.
Get it across.
I saw this bloke once at
how you get away with it with your lack of charisma, I don't know. It's a different thing.
I saw this amazing thing,
it's an
like
acquired taste.
No, I think you've got the perfect, I think to get away with a dark joke,
perfect physical structure.
You've got the perfect sort of
torso.
I think people trust that you are, you know, morally corrupt when you're on stage.
I think I'm a good guy and people, it, no, you know, that's a vibe. That's a vibe people get.
I totally think people trust you. They trust your judgment, and they can tell that you're right in the,
very
the joke. The joke is crafted to the point of, like, this is what this is worth listening to.
It's perfect.
Yeah. It's also been done so many times that it cannot fail.
It's bulletproof. Tried and tested.
People like policing other people's jokes. I remember, like, this was again about 10 years ago now, I saw this guy at an open mic night just get like a double tap shot from an audience, and it was it was amazing. So he went up and said this horrendous thing, and he went, little bit of ironic casual racism for you there. And this guy went, wasn't that ironic, mate? And he went like that, and then just from the other side of the room someone went, wasn't that fucking casual either? And he went, bang. And he just
laters, mate.
Yeah, and he finished and then went off, and you're like, that's fine, he will never do that again. He's gonna sit on the tube, he's gonna think about that, it will wake him up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, it didn't need a Twitter storm or someone to write an article about it. It's just like, it's fine, that's what those things are for.
Yeah, definitely. It's it's not. Yeah, it's quite nice. I quite like it when an audience just calls it. You know what I mean? And goes, come on, mate. You've had your fun. Yeah. Even not about stuff like that. I'm not talking about when people cross the line. I'm just talking about even when somebody's just bad. You know what I mean? I think I'm not for heckling. Don't get me wrong, but I do think sometimes an audience are allowed to point out if a comedian is just not good. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of ultimately, it's almost sort of Darwinian, isn't it? Like. I'm sure
character building stuff.
I must have told it on here before, but I remember doing a gig.
You should say that when you're comparing before you bring them on. Oh, by the way, guys, you have the right.
No, we got new at night. We got a tradition here at the Comedy Store of letting people on to try stuff out. Now, do remember, they are bad.
Don't forget the power you have.
Please do tell them.
Take the power back.
But no, like, I saw a guy do an open spot who was, you know, he was a guy who'd been around a few years. I think he's still kicking about. I don't think he was ever going to kick on from that, you know, mid-range gig to, like, he was, you know, you couldn't even perceive him at, like, the Comedy Store or something. Like, he'd be so out of place compared to the caliber of the other acts, right? relentless, isn't it? I reckon I've told it on here before, but I found this quite refreshing. But I was at the Birmingham Glee. This person was doing a middle spot of 10 minutes, and they went on a really solid bill. Opener had a real smasher. I think I was hosting, and this guy just went on and was just not good enough. Genuinely, like, he was treading water for 7 or 8 minutes, just getting the odd titter from a couple of people, so that, you know, it wasn't full silence. There was now and again, but it just wasn't good enough to be on that stage. And, you know, he kept sort of like acting like it was going all right, almost doing that weird NLP thing of like try and tell them it's going fine to try and convince the bookers that you're not dying on your ass. And then somebody from the audience just quite loudly went, oh, mate, you are boring, like that. And it fucking just sideswiped the guy. He couldn't recover from it, you know. And that's rude what that person did, but I have no issue with it. I was like, they have absolutely hit the nail on the head there. That person was not good enough. And I don't think that's... Yeah, it wasn't somebody who was doing their third gig and needed all the support in the world. This is somebody who'd been going for 7 or 8 years and needed to be told, you're not good enough for this gig.
Tough love, innit?
Yeah, I know it sounds harsh, but I think...
it's harsh, isn't it?
They were taking up the space of somebody who could have been a really... exciting person who'd been going a couple of years and was getting their first chance to show themselves at the game.
That's Simon Cowell's argument, isn't it? When people say, oh, he's really nasty. And he was like, you've got to nip this in the bud for a lot of people.
Sometimes I think you do. I don't think that should be the norm across the board. But like,
audiences do think that comedians are thicker skin than they are as well, don't they?
Totally. Yeah.
Like, he's up there, they probably think he's kind of thick-skinned, confident.
But he was acting thick-skinned and confident. And he was actually... cried that night, probably. I don't know if he did. I genuinely think he had the...
Just went and got a job behind the bar. Just leave, put the mic back in the stand. Got any vacancies?
Well, no, actually, he's
now... Put the chairs away after the gig.
You know, a very successful solicitor. He owes everything to that person.
It's true, though. That's probably happened, isn't it?
I don't think it happens that often in comedy. I was doing a gig with Pierre Novelli, and this guy that we'd met in Edinburgh was a really nice, really nice bloke. But again, he's one of those guys who was like, it's hopeless, it was never going to happen. And like he came down and he was like, all right. And we said, oh, do you want to go up? So we went up and he was dreadful. And then we were having a drink afterwards. And he was like, I've just quit my job. I've sold everything and I've moved to London. I'm going to make it as a comedian. And we were there like having a drink with him. And then he left and walked down the street. And Pierre's got he's really good at sort of nailing stuff like that. And he was just like, God damn, that's the saddest thing I've ever seen. Because that man basically just told us he was going to ruin his entire life. And there was nothing that we could do other than go, you go for it. He's going to take the only life he ever had and smash his head against a brick wall for the next 10 years.
Brutal, man.
Absolutely.
He might learn that. I mean, you know, in the other side of it, it's good he's kind of just going for it and taking a massive risk where the odds, I mean, it's not.
Well, no,
happen.
Because everybody has talents, don't they? Like, everybody is good at something.
But he might
someone
fail
like but you know, so many of those people don't stop, and it's, I think it's genuinely tragic.
they just don't stop.
Do you know what?
Stop.
Yeah, but you're like, you're good at something. Go and find out what that is. Like, there is that you will, like, your effort to reward ratio is going to be good for you.
But a lot of that thing that keeps people going long after they probably should, you know. And I don't get me wrong, I don't mind people who just do something as a hobby. I think they're absolute hobbyists are allowed in comedy. I've got no issue with that, right? Yeah. But it's the ones that you can tell think they're better than they are, and B, think it's gonna happen one day, and that they, because they've always, I think, obsessed with that sort of 10,000 hours Malcolm Gladwell type thing, or the Eddie Izzard 10-year thing. You don't
when
get
Eddie Izzard made
years.
That documentary, you had people like going around going, Eddie just died on his night arse every night for like 9 years, and then like one day he was he was playing the O2. And it like
and
that.
It's like, and you know,
people
like that.
Have got that X marked on their 10-year date, and they're just sitting there waiting. Yeah.
But it just doesn't happen. It's very rare. I can only think of a couple of
comedians. Go and gig on that 10-year day and just die again.
Just get a new calendar for 10 years' time. Put another X.
Another 10-year back to the drawing
board. If I was honest myself, I wasn't working for 5,000 of those 10,000 hours. Yeah.
But actually, like, I can only think of a couple of people that I've seen early doors and like within a few years, and I've thought, these are going to be the eternal open spot. And actually, you see them, and 3 years down the line, and they're like, "Oh fuck, they've actually kicked on, and they're starting to get it." Do you know what I mean? But it's a rarity. Yeah. Normally, you see them 3 years later; they're doing the same bad material.
If people work really hard, and they're honest with themselves, they can get better, can't they?
Yeah.
Well, it's not, as you mentioned earlier in the podcast, like it's often mistaken for an art, and it's not. It's a craft, and crafts can be artful, like beyond a certain point.
Yeah, I think there's a cross. There is a Venn diagram where comedy can be art.
But it's like
if you're doing comedy and if you go on stage and you're doing a bunch of jokes you're in, it's comedy. just because the people doesn't get laugh, it doesn't mean, doesn't prove it's not comedy. That's why it's similar to art as well, in that art is sort of in the eye of the artist rather than the beholder, isn't it?
I think it's a lot like cooking. I genuinely think like professional comedy is like chefing, in that like there's a basic skill level of like nice skills and knowing what mixes with what and structure and stuff. But then like at like the top level of it, you're trying to get ingredients that have never gone together before to do something. So when people say it's subjective, you go, yes, whether or not that quail is better than that steak is a matter of taste, but whether or not that egg is cooked or not isn't.
And I think that
subjectivity argument is used by people to go, it's just a load of smashed yolks on the floor and he's cut off his fingers.
Just a chef just throwing eggs out the door into the restaurant.
And you go, no, it's actually only subjective at the very top level. It's below a line, it's completely objective. And it doesn't help anyone to ignore that fact.
That is correct.
I actually thought, to steer it round onto food there, I thought we were going to talk about veganism a lot more than we have.
We never talk about veganism. It's almost like, I'd say it comes up about once every 20 episodes.
That's very disappointing because I'm interested.
Are you going to go vegan?
No, but I'm just
interested.
I'm just interested in it. It's one of those. I got gout during lockdown.
Sorry, it's funny.
Thank you very much.
It's funny because you're not a medieval king.
Yeah.
How do you get gout these days?
It's not from, like, people say, oh, it's port and red wine and all stuff like that. And I don't drink wine or spirits or anything. I just drink beer. And I thought during lockdown, I was being quite sensitive to have a couple of cans of beer here and there. But it was, you know, a lot of couple of three cans, four cans in the afternoon in succession. That'll really do it.
Plus dietary stuff as well.
A bit, but not a huge amount. But when you go on the NHS, it's to do with like purine levels in food and what you're eating and drinking. When you go on the NHS website, the purine index is the stuff of it that you wouldn't think would be on it, like sardines.
Right
at the top, sardines, tuna, certain types of pork, like red meat's quite far down the list. And the best way to get rid of it, you stop drinking and you go vegetarian for a bit. So I did that, and the best vegetarian cuisine that I found, Indian, they really stood out. I was talking to Ahishar about it, and he sent me a whole like Indian spice kit. I was like,
Vegetarian Indian, like it's vegan South Indian. You go down south, that is almost exclusively vegan. Mexican is the next best, I'd say, in terms of, you know, just take out the sort of meat and everything. Like, you can still like you just work with.
I associate sort of Mexican and South American food being quite cheese based.
Can be, but just take that out or use a vegan cheese. But like just
nice
in terms
bean
of like
burritos, Mexican,
tacos, all of that with black beans. You know, black beans are sort of the norm. Right. You know, it's actually, it's a very easy vegan.
Italian food's quite hard, isn't it?
Depends what you're going for. Like, you know, sort of your standard pasta dishes, you could easily to make vegan, innit? Well, if you've got a sort of, what's it called?
You've got eggs in pasta, though, haven't you?
No, standard pasta's just semolina.
Okay.
Wheat, whatever, Durham wheat. It's only egg, it specifies egg pasta, and it's that's the rarity.
Where are you guys on the whole, the fast food people clamouring to make vegan options?
I think it's good to have options everywhere, but like, you know, I'm not eating, I've never had a KFC vegan burger because I ain't going in KFC.
There's a new vegan Whopper.
Yeah, I mean, again, I've had one in an airport about 2 years ago and it was fine, but I'm not rushing back to Burger King.
I suppose
King
it's a good thing though, isn't it?
Yeah, I totally support it because I think it's good for... It's good for an emergency, for a vegan who can't find anything else. It's also good for a non-vegan who sees it and goes, oh, I'll try that, see what that's all about. I just saw Julian unrolling a toilet roll. I was about to drop a deuce on camera.
I've just got a toilet roll holder next to my bed from lockdown.
How long have you been vegan, Julian? Is it a relatively new thing for you?
About an hour. No, about 5 years. 6 years, maybe, something like that. I mean, I've slipped a handful of times in that time, but you know, 99% vegan in that time.
Yeah, I gave up bread once, and that was very difficult. So the idea of giving up, like, just things, like one of the things about our lifestyle, like motorway service stations and things late at night,
it is hard,
impossible to find things that don't have bread in them.
Yeah. Like,
all convenience food is some form of something wrapped in bread or something melted on bread.
Yeah, yeah. It's that any time I've gone on a little diet just to shift a few kilograms, the most successful ones have been cut out when I've cut out bread. I've tried to just stick to like proper whole foods, and after sort of dinner time, you know, once I've had my dinner, anything after that is just fruit or veg. I'm not allowed anything that's not fruit or veg. So on a late night, no matter what you say, you just ban yourself anything else. So you've got to eat a fucking banana and an apple on the way home, and that's it. And you just watch your body just go. Ooh.
Yeah, I did a couple of years ago. I gave up bread and did intermittent fasting and lost 2.5 stone in quite quickly.
How were you doing the fasting? Like 8 hours window, yeah, 16 hours.
8 hour window. So that's I'm actually doing that. I started doing that a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to.
It's really good for you as long as you get the right food in that 8 hours, eh?
Yeah, and it doesn't take long for you to adjust to it. Like first couple of days, like you're really hungry, and then literally by the end of the week when you start,
yeah,
like I didn't eat anything today till 11:30, so I'm sort of 11:07.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It wasn't like when we first started doing it, you're like, oh shit, when I get to 11 o'clock, you're like, right, yeah, and yeah, now yeah. I'm just like, oh, it's after 11, I'll have something to eat.
As yeah, opposed yeah.
to just take it easy, eh?
Yeah, yeah, because you don't have that, you're not. Yeah, the adjustment period is after 48 hours. I didn't find it like difficult at all.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is an indication that it's like, yeah, your body can adjust to this quite easily. It's quite a good idea.
Why did I got ill? I got gastroenteritis a few weeks back, and couldn't eat solid foods for a week, right? And at first 2 days I couldn't because I was literally bedridden and everything was coming out of my batty hole. And then I had a day where I tried to eat some, and that set it off again. So from the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I just went. Basically, I just drank water. I drank Dyrolites, so I was getting electrolytes and all that. And a couple of times I had a dry bit of toast. And, you know, actually I found there was a 2 day period where I didn't even have any dry toast. I literally was just drinking electrolytes every couple of hours. And by the end of the second day, the hunger had just gone. I was like, oh, right, I just don't eat anymore, apparently. Yeah. And my body felt, you know, I wasn't going to go for a run, you know what I mean? I wasn't full of energy, but I wasn't like crawling along the floor. It's funny. It's funny how quick your body adjusts.
Yeah, I quit smoking 6 months ago, 7 months ago now. No, longer than that. October, so nearly 9 months. And I'm now like because I've done that successfully. I'm like I can quit.
I can do anything.
I can do anything. I can quit all sorts of stuff. But that was like, I've tried to do that thousands of times before, and it's the cliche thing. Like Sarah's pregnant, so you're like. Right, stoptober, stopped.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And now, like, I don't miss it. I've slipped a couple of times, but one of the times that I slipped, like, my vape ran out of battery, and someone was like, "Oh, you can have a cigarette," and I took a toke on the cigarette, and then I just had to go to the loo immediately and just vomited battery acid, and my body was like, "No, like, absolutely,
yeah, that's
good. No." And it felt like, oh, okay, we've crossed a
bridge
here. But yeah.
What'll happen though, dude, because what happened to me when I quit smoking, I had that exact thing for the first year. Once I'd sort of got through that first couple of months, the thought of having one disgusted me. And like,
yeah.
I couldn't. I had a couple of drags when I was pissed. I was like, oh, that's disgusting. A couple of years down the line, I was at a barbecue and a bit pissed. And so give me a rolly. And I had it. And I was like, oh, this is actually relatively pleasant, but I don't want more than one.
Yeah,
and now I just exist in that. Every, I'd say once a quarter, I'll be a bit pissed and I'll have a couple of rollies off someone, and that is absolutely it. There's not a single part of me that wants to start smoking off the back of it. It feels like a little illicit memory from the past.
I really miss, like, since things have opened up. I think again, like, lockdown might have been something that's making it easier, but like, I really do miss the being able just to nip outside for a cigarette. Your little sort of social parachute. Like, sorry, I'm just gonna.
Away from this conversation.
Yeah, if you're just feeling slightly uneasy about something, or you're not enjoying a conversation or something, you can just, and there's no one deems it rude.
No, it's just allowed. And it's just
go, yeah, they go, yeah, that's absolutely fine. Stand outside.
Talking of that, we should probably end this conversation. I've just seen the time. We've been going. No, that, when you said that, I looked at the time. I was like, we've been banging on for over an hour.
What flavor vape do you have?
Mint.
Nice. Just pure menthol.
It's a V Pro
nicotine level.
This is 3 milligrams.
Right. Are you going to bring it down to
Well, it was. It started at 12, so I've gone 12.96 on three, which is which is pretty. That's pretty low.
And is the plan to take it to zero for and then see what happens?
Yeah, but it is. But I do like. I mean, Gillian and I have both been vaping throughout this conversation. I do quite like it, and it's one of those things of having a coffee or particularly having a pint.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to have a pint without a vape because it just that first like 2 inches at the top of a pint and it whatever your brain. It just switches off any cravings or anything.
Yeah.
But then I'm not sure I want to become one of those people who's just constantly surrounded by a cherry cloud of smoke.
Julian.
And I think I'm on the borderline of that at the moment, just like this mental vapor cloud around me. But I'll phase it out.
Right. So we should do some... thanks for coming on. It's been great. It's been really... It's flown by is what it's done.
Thanks very much for having me. As I said, all my stuff got cancelled because of the pingdemic.
I know. You got pinged. Have you been pinged or the stuff you were doing was ping related?
The Just the Tonic in Birmingham is closed this weekend due to pings. Fuck. 21 Soho in London is closed tonight due to pings.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah. God.
Bill Murray's shut due to pings.
I heard about that, actually. We're all on a tightrope, innit? I've been very lucky the last couple of weeks and not be pinged yet, but I'm sure it's going to happen at some point.
Delete the app.
Yeah, everyone's got to delete the app. Like, 2 North Down on Tuesday night was the opening night. 25 ticket holders didn't show up due to pings.
Well, a gig I was doing on Wednesday was cancelled because about two-thirds of the audience got pinged.
But the venues now don't have to have the little track and trace to come in, so they've all taken it down, and as Gillian said, everyone's deleting the app because I've double vaxxed.
There we go. Come on. We're sorted. Yeah. Quick plugs. You do a podcast.
I do a podcast. We're on a break at the moment, but there are 19-20 episodes of Laughable Series 1 you can go and have a look at.
With Red, Richardson and Jade Adams.
Indeed. And
both been on this pod, I think.
So, wicked. Okay, so complete the set.
Over the years. And also, Edinburgh, mate. When's your dates and where are your Edinburgh
Monkey Barrel, I think it is the 5th to the 12th? 10th? 5th? To something around then. I've got a new album out as well for the last show that we were allowed to do has just been released by 800 Pound Gorilla Records and is on it's called Smile and it's on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you want.
Excellent.
Yeah, so go and have a listen to that.
Have a bloody listen, mate. Well, that's the end of an episode.
We've thanks
a lot of fun. Thanks to Garrett for joining us. Thanks any admin Julian.
Thanks to all our new patrons.
Patrons, yes. New catch up went up on there yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be some more. We announced a little thing on there yesterday. It's a little secret, but we'll do that on here another time. And that's that, innit? People can sign up at patreon.com/wearetbi, but otherwise, episodes are going out weekly as normal on everywhere. Share it, give it a review. Just have fun, everyone. Don't get pinged. Garrett, cheers, mate. Good to see you.
Thanks,
good to see you, man.
That's all from me, Carl Donnelly.
And me, Julian Dean. Okay. My croaky vape voice.
All right, bye.
Bye.
We actually changed the podcast. I think you're
Julian. How you doing? I'm the accused of AIDS in an alleyway.